Let me add my own personal welcome to all of you this morning, if you are here in person or watching online, either today or some other day. We continue, as those of you who are regular here will be aware, our studies in Nehemiah. And we thank our brother Alex, who has introduced the series and given us some fantastic teaching over the last 3 weeks. I was looking at a website, one of these websites that track where Christians are being persecuted. And one of the lists I was looking at suggested that the most dangerous country to live in, if you're a Christian, is North Korea. And that's followed by Iraq and also Eritrea in the Horn of Africa. For our brothers and sisters who live in those countries, life is very difficult indeed because of the persecution they are subjected to. 317 million Christians are persecuted worldwide. Nearly 5,000 Christians were murdered for their faith last year, 2023. One in seven are persecuted worldwide. One in five in Africa. Two in five in Asia. 14,766 churches and properties are attacked worldwide. There are particular hot spots in Africa. One of those tends to be northeastern Nigeria because of the activities of Boko Haram. And in other parts, like we've mentioned in North Korea, there is systematic and widespread attacks on Christians. This should never come as a surprise to us, because the scriptures are full of warnings that this will happen. In Matthew chapter 5, verses 11 to 12, Jesus said to his disciples, "Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil things against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because your reward in heaven is great. For in the same way, they persecuted the prophets who were before you." In Mark 13, verse 9 to 10, "You must be on your guard. You will be handed over to the local councils and flogged in their synagogues. On account of me, you will appear before governors and kings as witnesses to them, and the gospel must first be preached to all nations." The Apostle Paul also adds, "You, however, know all about my teaching, my way of life, my purpose, my faith, my patience, my love, my endurance, persecutions, sufferings. What kind of things happened to me in Antioch, Iconium, Lystra, the persecutions I endured, yet the Lord rescued me from them all." In fact, Everyone who wants to lead a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted, while evil men and impostors will go on from bad to worse, deceiving and being deceived. So as they say, get used to it. Persecution comes with the turf if we are in Christ. Hebrews chapter 11 includes a list of all the heroes of faith to that point. And some of the ones they mentioned there, or don't mention but allude to, Daniel thrown into the lion's den, Meshach, Shadrach, Abednego thrown into a fiery furnace, Elijah escaped the sword of Jezebel's fury, Jeremiah faced jeers and flogging, some were chained and put in prison, they were stoned, they were sawed into two. That is a reference to Isaiah, who in the reign of Manasseh, very evil king in Judah, he took Isaiah, hung him upside down, and sawed him into two. They were put to death by the sword. The name Nehemiah is not specifically mentioned in that passage, but the experts tell us that the reference to those administering justice in chapter 11, verse 32, is a reference to Nehemiah. And this is particular reference to what he did in chapter 5. There are two possible sources of persecution. One is external, the other is internal. In this chapter, or in this book, we are given reference to external persecution in chapter 4, verse 7. Sanballat, Tobiah, the Ammonites, the Ashdodites, and the Arabs, all these were persecuting the Jews in their homeland. Paul in Acts, and in fact the rest of the early church, suffered persecution. One of the early church fathers, a gentleman by the name of Tertullian, is quoted as saying, actually, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. A very wise saying, and when we read church history, and church history could be written from the point of view of what persecution were happening when. And as we read those persecutions, about those persecutions, we'll almost always find that after a period of severe persecution, the church grows. There is a spike in the growth of the church. You can imagine that if you've ever sat at a campfire, when the fire is burning, eventually the logs get separated because of the fire burning. But if you push them together, you don't even have to blow on the fire, the flame will immediately rise. And so it happens in persecution or times of persecution. The hangers-on move out because they don't want to be in those uncomfortable situations. But as the believers hang on to each other, something happens. There is almost always an explosion of growth. Hence the saying, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. So that's from outside. What happened to the early church happens in our time, as those statistics I was reading point to. But there is also internal persecution, which really is the point of much of chapter 5 of Nehemiah. And again, it's nothing new. We know from chapter 6 of Acts that as the church was just beginning to grow, within amongst themselves, several things began to happen. And the one that is recorded in chapter 6 is complaints. One side of the church complaining against the other side. They felt injustices which were perpetrated by the other side. So they complained, and that had the danger of tearing the young church apart. And Peter, James, and the others sat down and they sorted that matter out. Persecution does come from within the church. And in fact, the persecution that comes from within the church is usually more dangerous than the persecution that comes from outside, as we will see in this chapter, where poverty and destitution on account of an oppressive lending regime, including 10% interest, failure to repay led to mortgaging of fields, houses, and eventually selling off children into slavery. And all the lenders and their customers were engaged together, seemingly, in rebuilding the wall. But half the people, more than half the people, were suffering. And it was recognized that this is a form of persecution needed to be addressed. An interesting little bit here, in I think it's in verse 1. The men and their wives raised a great outcry against their brothers. Another time where we read about a great outcry was when the people in Egypt were subjected to severe slavery, and they raised this great outcry. The Lord heard and sent Moses to rescue them. Here, the Lord heard this outcry, and Nehemiah stepped into the breach to sort it out. A theme running through all this is that when persecution comes and the people cry out from under the burden of persecution, the Lord hears and he does something about it. Just as he raised Moses, so he raises Nehemiah here. So what was Nehemiah's response? In verses 5 to 6 to 7, we heard James reading, "I was angry." Quite often, as good Christian people, we are afraid of anger. We think it is beneath a Christian to be angry. But actually, anger is not very different from hunger or thirst. When you're thirsty, the body is saying something is going wrong. You're getting dehydrated. If you don't take in liquids, something desperate might happen to your body. It's a warning system. So you drink water and your health is restored. If that's the point of that. But anger is also just a warning system. Something has gone wrong here, your body tells you. Your mind tells you something has gone wrong, and if you don't do something about it, it's going to get worse. So when Nehemiah heard the outcry, he became angry. And the advantage of anger is that it comes with energy to do something about it. And that's also the problem. Because most of us, if you are anything like me, that energy then is used destructively. And there are horrible stories that one can repeat of people who became angry. The anger simply say, there's something wrong here. Do something about it. And the energy is given so that we can constructively solve the problem. But because of sin, we use that energy destructively to hurt the person we perceive to be the cause of our anger. So do not be afraid of anger, but do not use the energy it brings to destroy, but use that energy to build up, to get rid of the injustices, to get rid of the oppressive regimes in a way that restores what God intends to happen. So Nehemiah says to them, he tackles them, "You are charging unfair and illegal interest on loans by your own countrymen," he says to them. "God does not want people to benefit from the misery and poverty of others." We live in a world where people are put into boats to go on the high seas, almost certainly for a lot of them, going to their deaths. And the amounts of monies that the traffickers collect are incredible. They are not just those who do those, there are many others. And these things should make us angry, as they did Nehemiah. And they should, therefore, we should combine our energies, which come from that anger, in order to put a stop to those who, in countries like Eritrea, Iraq, and so on, are benefiting from collecting money from those who are driven out of their countries to go and seek welfare somewhere else. His own example, he says, "We are buying back slaves from the Gentiles. We are lending grain without interest. I forgo the governor's rights because the burden is too heavy on the people. And we are also generous to many, many people. The table is laid and we invite lots of people to come and eat. Therefore, my brothers and sisters, let us leave off charging extortionate interest which the poor cannot afford." And we have lots of examples in the scriptures where God is the God of the poor, as we were singing not so long ago. So he makes a very powerful moral argument based on the unfairness of the lending regime and its effect on the poor people, as well as his own personal moral authority based on generosity. So how do we deal with disaffection in the ranks, which threatens to destroy our unity? The matter must be dealt with openly. The advantaged should be required to forego some of their what they perceive to be their rights. Verse 12, where we read, "They agreed, 'We will give it back,' they said, 'and we will not demand anything more from them. We will do as you say.'" And the disadvantaged have their burdens relieved. As we see in Acts chapter 7, they nominate the seven men and they ask them to ensure there's equity in the distribution of the food in the early church. Well, I could go on, but persecution will come when you're serving the Lord faithfully. We could ask that if we don't experience persecution, That is the abnormal situation. And it might be that Satan can go to sleep because he knows there's nothing happening here. But where he sees something happening, certainly he will rise up and persecute the people. Job is a particular example that most of us are familiar with. Satan says, it's only because you've protected him. That's why he serves you. And the rest of the story we all know. Persecution comes from external and internal sources. And many people during those times will benefit incredibly from the weak and defenseless, placing unbearable burdens on them in order to line their own pockets. But that's not the God we serve. He is the one who said to the Israelites, every 3 years, bring food into the priests so that food can be distributed to the Levites, but especially to the poor people, to the foreigners, and to those who have nothing. So we too need to personally and corporately learn to mirror God's love and action in regard to those who suffer injustices, the marginalized and the deprived. And Moses and Nehemiah protected God's people in times of persecution. And our leaders too are called upon to do the same. Well, let's spend just a few moments of quiet and in your own way, reach out to God in response to what you have heard from the scriptures this morning. And then we'll move straight into the communion. So let us be quiet and pray.